Welcome to HR Unpacked, a podcast about HR workplace issues, where we analyse and then discuss the latest developments in HR and employment law that impact both employers and employees.
Great, thanks, Jonathan, and welcome to everyone who's on the podcast today. My name's Kate Palmer, and we're really pleased to have Professor Rob Drummond on with us today, who is a professor in linguistics. So thank you so much for giving your time to us today. The subject matter is accent discrimination and whether that should be deemed as a protected characteristic, plus obviously an array of other talking points that we're going to extract today. So thank you so much. And well placed here on the table is your book, You're All Talk, Why We Are What We Speak. So I don't know whether to kick us off, Rob, if you want to give us a bit of insight into what your book's about and the subject matter you research would be great.
Yeah, it's really, so it's a book about the relationship between spoken language and identity, or how we speak and who we are. So that's the kind of subject I've been researching for a long time, teaching about for a long time, writing about for a long time. But the book is aimed at a kind of a public, it's a public facing book. So it doesn't need any specialist knowledge. It's not an academic book in that sense, but it draws on a lot of academic research, but hopefully explains it in a way that's kind of accessible to lots of people. Because to be fair, it's the kind of subject that most people have an interest in, because everyone has an accent.
Yeah.
Everyone's got a story about an accent, and sure enough, whenever I talk about the book or go on, you know, give talks or at events, everybody has something to say, because it's something that everyone can relate to, because we all have something, you know, something we can draw on.
Yeah.
Whether it's ourselves personally or somebody we know, there's something, everyone has a story about the way they speak.
That's exactly what we said actually before, isn't it?
Yeah.
The kind of scenarios where we feel our accent has come into play, which we may well discuss as the session goes on, but yeah, brilliant, thank you.
So you've been researching accents for a while. How on earth do you get into that kind of research area?
So this all started when I used to be an English language teacher, so I used to teach English as a foreign language, EFL. And I was teaching abroad for a while, and then I was teaching back in Manchester. And I just noticed that some of my students were kind of, when they were learning English, they were starting to pick up a Manchester accent, which kind of made sense because they were living here, but some of them didn't, and I thought that was kind of interesting, and it came at a similar time when I was sort of looking for something. I really enjoyed what I was doing, but I sort of wanted to sort of progress, and so the opportunity of a PhD came along, and so I thought this would be an interesting subject to research, and so that is what my PhD was about, about whether I looked at Polish people specifically, whether Polish people in Manchester acquired a Manchester accent. And I kind of came to the conclusion that it was, you know, it was down to lots of things, but a lot of it was down to how they felt about Manchester, whether they were coming to Manchester in order to live and settle down and wanted to be part of the community, or whether they were just coming to Manchester for a few years to work and then go home to Poland. And that kind of played a big part. So from that moment on, I just started getting more and more interested in that link between, like say, the way we speak and who we are, and what influences the way we speak, and again, whether people face kind of problems because of the way they speak.
So just on that point then, was it the finding that those who were staying in Manchester for a longer period were adopting the accent more?
It was a bit more, it was even more kind of interesting than that. It didn't really matter how long they'd been here, it was what they intended to do was almost the most important thing. So it was almost like, you know, the way I interpreted it anyway was that people who had that intention of being here, intention of settling, of wanting to be part of the community, kind of subconsciously or consciously were sort of more prone to taking on that accent, because, you know, it goes back to that fact that it's such an important part of who we are. Mm-hmm. And so whether those people knew they were doing it or not, it's a sense that brings me closer to the people I'm around. And I guess people with a more positive view towards Manchester and a positive view towards the people here. And that's how it happened.
Yeah.
Was a Mancunian Polish accent created out of that? Because you know, from a layperson, you do see kind of certain accents when people from not from the UK come to the UK, they adopt the kind of accent.
Yeah.
And you know roughly what area they're from as well. Did that come out of your research?
Yeah,
well?
It does. It does really. And I think that's, you know, that's a big part of how accents are created anyway. It's always a mixture. It's always people. You know, it's people that, like, language doesn't really exist without people. It needs. We think of language as a kind of a living thing because you think of so-called dead languages like Latin, because there's no one who has Latin as a first language. So we think of it as living, but it's only living because people are using it all the time. And it's that mixture, it's that contact between people that creates accents anyway and creates mm-hmm. different ways of speaking. So absolutely, there's really, you know, you can hear a kind of a Polish Manchester accent where there is a kind of mixture of those two things going on. And it would sound different from this accent of somebody, a Polish person who'd kind of, you know, was settling down in Leeds or in Birmingham or in London or whatever. So, yeah.
Can I ask a bit of a thick question? And sorry if this is a little bit simplistic, but why do accents exist? You know, we're a few miles up the road from Liverpool and you couldn't get two more distinct accents, a Liverpudlian and a Mancunian. Why is that?
So, well, that's interesting. So, historically, it's because of the different groups of people who've kind of lived here and in the UK. So the UK has loads of accents. The UK is especially rich for accents because it's a relatively small place geographically, but it has so much kind of diversity in the way people speak. And that's really down to kind of historical roots of lots of different groups of people, you know, living here, right from, you know, people usually go back to kind of about 500 AD when kind of Angles and Saxons and Jutes came over from what's now kind of Germany and Denmark. And then you had, you know, that's where Old English came from. But then you had things like, you know, the Vikings came over in the 8th century using a different language, using Old Norse. And so there was contact there. And then the Normans came over with French, Norman French, which became Anglo-French. And so you got all these different ways of speaking. And of course, there wasn't much communication between the different areas. And as English developed as the dominant language, people were using it in very different ways.
Right.
So, and language will always develop and change, and quite naturally, it changes, you know, in its pronunciation. So all these different versions of English were free to develop in their own way. But that only explains why we had so many accents, you know, in the past. Because now, of course, we have the same. We have the same influences, we communicate, we travel, we listen to the same media. Mm. So in that sense, you kind of think, well, accents should have died out. But the reason there are still so many accents, and like say in the Northwest is particularly rich, I think, is because of identity, because that link to who we are, that it's the way we speak is one of the ways in which we're able to say, look, I belong to this group of people, and I don't belong to that group of people. And that might be a region thing, it might be a social class thing, it could be a gender thing, a race and ethnicity thing, a sexual identity thing. It's our way of saying, you know, I align with this group and this set of values and whatever, and this region, and I want to distinguish myself from that group, which is why people, you know, especially from quite important cities like Liverpool and Manchester and Birmingham, will have that, maybe the regional pride as well, and that comes through. And so I think it's that's why we still have them.
Yeah, so interesting, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Have you faced some resistance to the research that you've done?
I think only in the sense that I'm very much kind of an advocate of all accents sort of being equal, and that, you know, whether that's a regional thing or a class thing or a young person thing. So I've done a lot of work with young people. And I did a big project with young people who've been excluded from school, and they're being educated in a pupil referral unit. And, you know, young people face a lot of criticism sometimes. You know, they should speak properly, and they get told, you know, they get told the idea that English is kind of deteriorating because of them, and they don't know how to use grammar properly anymore, and all of these things. So I'm there to say, well, no, that their way of speaking is just as sophisticated. It's just different. And they're using it in it partly again to differentiate themselves, to sort of say, this is our own language. I'm not, you know, I'm not one of you. I'm part of this group. So because I'm kind of saying all that, then I guess the criticism I get is people saying, well, you know, it's too kind of, well, you know, I get called, you know, I got labeled as professor of woke after an appearance on TV one time talking about this kind of thing. It's that kind of sense that I'm saying people can't have preferences about accents. And they say, well, yeah, I like this accent. What's wrong with that? And there's nothing wrong with that. As long as not you're not then using that preference to treat people in different ways, mm-hmm. I guess. So I guess that's the only sort of, I think naturally people tend to have quite conservative views about language.
Yeah.
That they think English is changing and it is deteriorating and that, you know, the grammar rules we learned, you might have learned when you were at school, if you even looked at grammar, that's kind of correct. And you're sort of looking at how language is kind of changing and getting worse. And so, you know, when somebody comes along to say, no, actually, this way of speaking is absolutely fine, and it's absolutely fine that these words don't mean what you think, what they used to mean, then people sometimes resent that. Mm. But.
So we obviously come from HR backgrounds, and your accent is not a protected characteristic under the equality laws.
Yeah.
Have you seen cases of discrimination based on people's accents? Is that something you've come across in your research or not, as the case may be?
It is. So kind of a lot of this is anecdotal in terms of, I run a project called the Accentism Project, which is basically a way of people, it really just kind of collects and shares stories of language-based prejudice. So people are free to send in stories anonymously and we put them on the site. And so it's hard to, I wouldn't say this is, you know, we can kind of verify all of these things, but these are certainly people's experiences. And they do talk about, exactly that they've had kind of negative comments made about the way they speak or being told to change the way they speak for certain situations. And I think that is potentially quite problematic.
Because we're from the same neck of the woods, aren't we?
We are,
really,
yeah.
Jonathan?
Oldham.
Oldham, yeah. And I don't know, have you ever experienced it?
I have, yeah. I've dealt with it at work, definitely. Mm. But I remember being at university in Scotland, and I'd say I was from Manchester because people didn't know where Oldham was from. And then my parents came to visit with a friend, and my friend said, oh, some more Manx are on the scene. And my parents' friend said, we're not from Manchester, we're from Oldham.
Right.
And then she started to tell them the difference between Manchester and Oldham, and most of it was the accent about some of the words that they use.
Yeah.
And they were kind of from Lancashire rather than from Manchester. It was a massive thing. And that's when I first really thought about, there is a bit of, not discrimination, but people do kind of silo you into certain areas.
Mm. Yeah.
But I've definitely faced it in terms of jobs, when you've applied for jobs and when you speak to other people as well. And I don't think necessarily, you might think differently from your research and have evidence. So this is just my personal experience, but it hasn't been kind of north and south divide for me. It's no matter where I've been in Manchester as an area, it's just people's perception of the accent. So people from Oldham could not like another person's accent from a certain part of Oldham as well.
Right.
It's that granular sometimes.
Interestingly,
that's where I felt it more. I went to quite an affluent university down in the Midlands.
Right.
And I was probably one of the only Northerners.
Yeah.
And I took it with a pinch of salt, but I used to get called Mrs. Merton, you know.
Yeah.
And I definitely felt that there was a lack of seriousness that maybe some of the other people got around our studies and so forth. There's always a bit of the character in the room, you
exactly.
know.
Exactly. Well, you're saying about, you know, you laughed it off, and that's absolutely. And so a lot of people, you talked about kind of, do you get any criticism for what you research? And people will sometimes say, you're making too much of this, and say, I just laugh, you know, get a thicker skin, you know, just laugh at it. We just laugh about stuff. It's fine. But, you know, you kind of think, well, why should you? Because you're the person it's happening to. This other person, purely by chance, purely because they grew up in, I don't know, like Hertfordshire, where I'm from, rather than Oldham, they wouldn't get that. Mm. You know, they might get told they sound a bit posh sometimes, but that's really not doing anyone too much harm. It's still problematic. I think basically, I think any kind of stereotyping due to the way you speak is a problem.
Yeah.
But I think it can be, you know, particularly negative sometimes. And so it's like, you can, you know, sort of laugh it off, but it was happening all the time. And I see it with, I see my own kids, my own daughter. We lived in Bolton. She's lived in Bolton all her life. And then she went down to university again in the Midlands. And yeah, she had the same thing, you know. And it's like, and I see it with my students here. They come from different places. And even if it's just, you know, silly things like, oh, you know, listen to the way she says that. Oh, say that again.
Yeah.
Come and, you know, listen to, oh my God, she says that really funny. And it's like, you know, dealing with that all the time. Yeah, this is at the obviously the very mild end of kind of stereotyping, prejudice, discrimination, whatever. But it's the same kind of thing. It's just at different strengths. You can get a lot more serious, but it's the same overall thing. It's labeling somebody, it's pigeonholing somebody purely because of the way they speak.
Yeah.
And that's a problem.
Well, interestingly, in your book, you talk about back in the 1400s that there wasn't any hierarchy in accents. Is that right? Has that changed over time? Or
yeah. So that was really just the kind of development of English, in the sense that, like I say, different versions of English kind of developed in different ways, but there was no sense, real sense, that one was better than another. And it was only when it gradually the language became, we see it as being, became standardized.
Yeah.
When in the late kind of 15th century, this guy called William Caxton came along and set up a printing press. And so at that in London, and at that point, you're then creating a standard version of the language. Until then, it was just sort of different, you know, different regions had different ways of using language. But then you're kind of saying, well, this has a bit more authority. And of course, the variety he used for that was the variety of London and the Southeast and Oxford and Cambridge and whatever. And so that then gave it that sense of status. And that's really where it started. So then, and different varieties of language only get the status because of the people using it. So there's nothing objectively better about, you know, so-called standard English or a so-called or a received pronunciation accent, which is sort of based on a Southeast England model. There's nothing better about that. It's just that's the way of using language that the people with power had.
Mm.
So therefore, it gains that prestige, and then people wanting to join the kind of prestigious people would learn to use that way of speaking, and that was seen as a way of getting up in the world. That's the way of speaking that was then encouraged in kind of private schools and Oxbridge and so on. And so it's just this kind of ongoing self-perpetuating thing. So that's really, I guess, when there began to be hierarchies of different ways of using English. And then that just developed, and it's still the same now. That's still the model.
Mm.
You know, that's seen as because it's the language of the BBC, it's the language of broadcasting, of government, of authority.
Mm.
And so it still has that prestige.
Yeah.
That notion of power really, it kind of hit home, that, because I think people do change accents to kind of move on in society, I think, and in obviously work as well, but definitely move on in society. And you can definitely, I've noticed people do change their accents to come across more powerful.
Yeah.
You know, you can definitely see that, especially in the workplace.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. And it's like, it's a tricky one, that, because you kind of think on a personal level, I would never kind of criticize anyone for doing that. You've got to kind of do what you got to do. And I think this is especially true when I've worked with young people, and on the one hand I'm saying, oh, you know, it doesn't matter. The way the young people are speaking is totally valid. It's sophisticated. It's good. It's intelligent. But then teachers will say, well, it's all very well you saying that, but if they've got a kind of college interview tomorrow, and we know, we're telling, if he doesn't change the way he speaks, they're not going to be that impressed.
Yeah.
So I would never, on an individual level, I kind of say, yeah, you know, do what you got to do. But what I would do is, we've got to kind of challenge the society that means that is the case. You've got to challenge the idea that you need to do that in order to get ahead. That shouldn't be the case. So, you know, I would never, like I say, never criticize an individual for doing what they need to do, but I would challenge the kind of system and the society that means that's even necessary in the first place.
It's a big thing in discrimination at the moment, especially things like sex discrimination, where I think historically research has really focused on changing the individual. In sex discrimination, for example, it was changing the female to become more male in terms of their personalities and the attributes. But now it's about changing the job so that the job then reflects what that individual is like and the skills they can actually bring without changing them.
Do you think
that's the future for accents, then? Do you think it will be less where this powerful accent dictates what people have to do?
I think so. I think that, and that's the aim. That's where we need to get to. I mean, there's huge kind of gender disparities anyway within speech as well, because women routinely have kind of get criticized for the way they speak more than men. And again, there's that sense that, you know, you can look online and or in the past look in kind of magazines, there'll be so many articles. Once you start looking for, you know, kind of how to be taken seriously in the workplace, and it'll really be aimed at women saying, don't do this, don't apologize, don't say sorry too much, don't say sorry, don't keep saying like, don't make sure you don't go up at the end of a sentence, all of these things. What's happening is these bits of advice are saying, basically saying, sound more like a man in order to get ahead. So do these things that are typically seen as women's language and men's language, which just is a really just a patently bad kind of take anyway, because the more you look at it, there isn't such a thing as women's language and men's language. There's so much kind of variation within women. Not all women speak in the same way. Like, not all women experience being a woman in the same way. Not all men experience being a man in the same way. And that same goes for language. So, but all of these articles tend to be, you know, targeted at women. Change this, change the way you speak. And so I think that's a really good, you know, like what you said there about that's what we should be aiming for with language, in terms of kind of changing the way people listen rather than telling people to change the way they speak. That's where you want to get to. You want to kind of get people to be more accepting of diversity in language, in the same way that people quite rightly have been kind of, you know, have been encouraged or forced to become more accepting of diversity in all sorts of areas. Same for language.
So interesting you say that, because on the way here I was having a chat with my colleague and we're discussing the fact that is it accent discrimination, or is it in fact another protected characteristic that is being talked about as though it's an accent issue, but in fact it's because you're a woman or it's because you're young. And I do think they all kind of mutate into one.
It's exactly that. That's exactly what it is. So the thing kind of, you know, I was giving a talk yesterday to a load of A-level students down in London. And the kind of last point I ended with was that, you know, criticism about the way somebody speaks is always about more than language.
Yeah.
There's always something more going
on.
Yeah,
so interesting,
isn't it?
And it's like it can be used, it's so easy to be used as a kind of a proxy for other things.
Yeah.
You can sort of say, you can imagine in a kind of recruitment situation, you could say, well, you know, this person, you know, they'd be fine, but they don't really fit in because, you know, the voice wouldn't quite fit in. It wouldn't kind of match our kind of clients. Really,
yeah.
Is that what you're saying? Or are you saying like it's a class issue, saying that they're too working class to work in your nice company?
Yeah.
Or, you know, our clients wouldn't understand. They wouldn't understand your accent. Really? Is that it? Or is it because it's just not quite kind of white enough? You know, I think it is, you know, like that. It's a way of shielding yourself from other prejudices. It's an acceptable form of prejudice somehow. You can say these things about voice that you wouldn't say about other things, but
probably because of the other things, you'd get a potential discrimination claim tribunal as well.
Exactly.
In
terms of companies then, because I know you speak to obviously young people as well, in terms of companies, it must be difficult because they have to work with their clients. And if the client wants something, generally the company has to deliver.
Yeah.
So is there any kind of advice or anything that companies could do to maybe influence the clients to say, well, actually, this person is competent enough to do the job, regardless of the accent? Or do you think that will always be an issue?
I think it's something that it needs to be changed, but it's really hard to do on a kind of case-by-case basis, because you're absolutely right. People will face those kind of, you know, face those problems. And so it needs a big shift. It's not it needs a kind of a more fundamental shift than, like I say, that's a similar situation to me telling the teacher or the young person, okay, you know, yeah, you might have to change the way you speak, but it's wrong, but you might have to do it. But I think part of the way we do that is to give that young person all the information. Say, this is why, yeah, you might have to change the way you speak. This is why. It's wrong that you have to, but just so you know that kind of society is not equal.
Mm.
And so we need to challenge that, but kind of give them all the information. Then it's kind of up to them what they do. And I think it's similar for that. We just need to we need people to be talking about it more, which is why this kind of thing is so useful. Giving people that awareness to then at least reflect on those decisions they're making and those attitudes they have. And I think that's, in some ways, that's, well, I mean, that's what the book's aiming to do in a lot of ways, is just to get people to think, you know, why do I prefer this accent? Or why don't I like that accent? Or why do I have a problem with that? And you know, because once you start thinking about objectively why you like this accent over this accent, it doesn't really make any sense. Yeah. They're just sounds that we make with our mouth. Why should that one be so objectionable? There's more to it. And so just getting people to think about that, I think, oh, actually, yeah, maybe it's a bit of an issue. Maybe I do have a bit of underlying kind of prejudice.
Do you think there's a shift? Because I always go back to Steph McGovern on the BBC, and I was reading in advance of today, she got a letter sent to her where someone included £20 or something.
That's
and
right.
said, go and sort out your affliction.
Yeah.
But you do hear in broadcasting now more accents, you know, the introducers to programmes on the news.
Yeah.
Are we seeing a shift?
Definitely. So that's a good thing. And the BBC, to be fair, with, you know, even though they were, as an institution, were responsible for a lot of the you know, putting received pronunciation on a pedestal, but that's like we're talking back in the 1920s and 30s. They've done a lot, you know, pretty much since the 60s and 70s to have much, you know, much more kind of diversity in the voices. And they do. And they're still, they do it a lot more. So, yeah, you hear far more voices, and not just BBC, across broadcasting, you hear far more different kind of voices, which is great. I mean, all of the mainstream news readers, all of the, anyone who's reading the big ones at kind of News at 10 or whatever, or 6 o'clock news, they've still got the same kind of accent generally, most of them. So there's still a way to go, but no, we are having a shift, and it's good. And then it's good when you hear people standing up. So another person who gets a lot of stick is Angela Rayner, as an MP. She gets a lot of stick, and she speaks out about it. And it's kind of good to have those conversations. And when you see, you know, when you see things start to shift a little bit, I think it's good. So I think it's good when people get to positions of authority in either in broadcasting, in politics, or in business, or whatever, when they do have voices that are kind of a bit outside of what's been the mainstream. I think it's a good thing, because it will start to give people that confidence.
Okay. Is there a difference between accent and eloquence, do you think?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And yeah, again, you know, it's a sort of criticism sometimes have to deal with, because you're saying, well, you know, all accents are equal and we should be more embracing. But of course, there is a fact that some people are able to, you know, are kind of better at public speaking, that kind of thing. And I do get that. And I'm not kind of dismissing that. I think that's a skill that can be learnt. And there are clearly people who are better at public speaking than others, and so they have that kind of eloquence, if you like. But I think the important thing is that you can be eloquent in any accent, and that's what's often missed. Yeah. And I think people with the right kind of accents can get away with not being eloquent at all. So you can see this a lot with, you know, certain politicians, you know, over recent years, will speak in a way that they'll have this real received pronunciation accent. They're not communicating very well at all, but they can kind of get away with it because they have that accent. Whereas if it was somebody with a less prestigious accent, they'd be kind of pulled apart for what they're saying, and they have to almost work that bit harder, which is how society, inequality works, isn't it? That people have to work harder to get to the same stage. And I think that's true with voices.
Roger Moore, the actor, James Bond, he always said that he didn't trust people who spoke slowly and clearly. He said he thought they were too premeditated.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Too staged. He said they were too premeditated in the thoughts. You know, they were thinking quite clearly about what to say. And it wasn't natural what they were saying as well. And he always said, I didn't really trust them that much.
Right.
Yeah. It's James Bond for you.
Do you think that if anti-discriminatory laws were brought into fruition, and accent discrimination was a protected characteristic, that it would change the way businesses think? Because obviously we've got sex discrimination, we've got age discrimination. There is still a lot of discrimination out there.
Yeah.
Do you think it would impact?
I think it would. I think it'd be a good thing. I think that's what we should be aiming for, because I think it would be complicated, as all of these things are, but it would make people think. So I imagine what happened when, you know, various kind of laws came in with sex discrimination and all sorts of things. people would, it made people think, you know, am I being, you know, this situation, am I being sexist? Am I doing this? And you know, my argument is, if you're having to think that thing, you probably are. If you're having to stop, but at least it will make people think. So if there was something in law or in even just in guidance to do with voice, then people would think, hold on, is this, what am I doing here? Is this discriminatory? And it would make people think. So I think it would be a good
step
forward.
Definitely.
Mm. Along with other things as well. So you've got these, you know, these protected characteristics. I was at an event last summer, actually, down at in the House of Commons. Somebody, there was a debate about, not in the government itself, but a side thing about kind of updates to the Equality Act. And people were kind of suggesting different areas where that maybe should be protected characteristics. And I had a few things to say about where the voice should be. And so I think it's good to have that conversation and to think what else could be, in a sense, because like we said before, other prejudices get hidden kind of underneath it.
Yeah.
And so I think it would be a useful thing to do.
Just a question around equality in the laws then. With most discrimination legislation as a framework of what that discrimination is, do you think you could frame accent discrimination so you could define what discrimination is based on their accent? Or do you think it's a bit like social and economic discrimination? It's too difficult to say you're from Liverpool, so therefore you've got a certain accent.
Yeah, I think it would be difficult to do, but I think it would be an interesting thing to work on.
Yeah.
So I think there's a few of us sort of working in this area where we're starting to have those kind of conversations to think, well, what would it look like? What could it look like? And whether it's possible. So I think it's a discussion definitely worth having.
Mm. What would your advice to business be around this subject matter?
Just to be more open, to try and let go. It's so embedded. It's so embedded in us that certain ways of speaking are good, because we get taught it. You get taught it at school, even if it can be quite direct or quite indirect, but you know, so like, speak properly, do this, you know.
Yeah. Is that a British thing, or is that around the world as well?
Oh, that's good. It is around the world in different kind of ways. So, and different countries have quite different attitudes towards it. But for example, in France, they quite strongly, there's kind of seen as a correct way of speaking French, and they have this Académie Française, which is supposedly looks after the French language. And we don't really have anything like that. But, you know, different countries do have similar things. And again, there'll be a prestigious way of speaking. Mm. And it's usually, again, to do with power or, you know, historic power and whatever. And so, yeah, I think it's looking at those sort of, you know, we don't like to think of them as prejudices in our own minds, what we're doing. But we do have a kind of hierarchy of ways of speaking in our minds. And when we do hear someone, we do make assumptions and you do pigeonhole people, because you know that, because then you notice when somebody is a bit different. If you hear somebody, you expect them to speak in one way and they speak in another way, we notice it. Mm. And so you kind of think, well, hold on, why am I noticing that? In the same way that people might have done in the past to do with race and ethnicity or gender, you kind of think, well, you see a person in a role, say, oh, you know, wow, I wasn't expecting them to be a woman, or I wasn't expecting them, you know. It's like, well, why? And it's the same thing with voice. You kind of think, well, I wasn't expecting that voice. Well, why weren't you expecting that voice? And can we do anything about it?
It's that constant challenge of it, isn't it? We work with a lot of SMEs where the race for talent now is really challenging, but they still have unconscious bias where, you know, they're missing out on really good talent because of accents or because of another protected characteristic. And I think for me, the businesses I see, they've really got to do deep training on unconscious bias and how to overcome that.
Yeah. Nelson Mandela mentioned at the end of his autobiography, to free the oppressed, you have to first free the oppressors. And what you said in reading your book as well, it's a bit like that, where you've got to change the mindset of the people. In this case, what we're talking about, the employers and society changing their mindset rather than changing the individual.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. That, I think that's it. It's going back to, you know, the responsibility on, if we want a more equal society, it has to be, came across a really nice term. I think I mentioned in the book, but it's from this author, Rosanna Lippi Green, who talks about accent bias, but also in films, because there's a lot of kind of accent hierarchies in films and drama, but it's talk about the communicative burden and whether the communicative burden should be on the speaker or the listener. And I think if we want more a more equal society, it's kind of shifting that burden onto the listener to be, like I said, to become better listeners, become better at listening to people rather than getting people to kind of change the way they speak in order to fit your preconceptions, maybe change your preconceptions.
Good stuff. Well, thanks, Rob. It's been great having you as guest. The book I can highly recommend. It's a fascinating read. I really enjoyed it, and your research is fantastic as well, especially for young people as well. So thanks for coming on to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's just so you don't think. I'd like to think I don't change my accent, but sitting here now, I'm thinking back, and I know I do on the telephone when I'm doing something like this.
You do, but that's fine. I think that's all right.
It's,
but you know,
it's interesting that you do it, though, isn't it?
Yeah, that's an all right thing to do. It's just like, you know, there's different kind of you're using different identities. You're just there's different parts of you, and that's absolutely fine. I think it's a natural thing to do.
Nod of approval. Yeah. Thanks, Rob.
You can watch HR Unpacked on YouTube, and also you can listen to HR Unpacked on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other platforms. Just search for HR Unpacked.